And a good Sunday evening, everyone, and welcome back to Sith's Basement, where anything and everything goes. Tonight, we've got a packed show for you tonight, so let's get started, because first up, we have numbers 75 to 51, and the top 90s films you have to see before you die. We're going into my Twitter inbox for some more Q&A, and for once and for all, I'm going to explain why the whole hoopla around the council culture in this country is fabricated bullshit. Yeah, it's going to be a huge deep dive tonight, so let's get this party started, and the firecrackers going off as well. It's a loaded show. So let's get back to the countdown, shall we, first and foremost. Coming at number 75 is Predator 2. Now, this I'm pretty sure I've told Katara, but the sequel to Predator actually carried an NC-17 rating initially from the MPAA because of its graphic violence. And honestly, this is actually a decent watch. Okay, this time, it's 1997, 10 years after the events in the first Predator, and we're in LA for this one, as the Predator is going up against a police officer and his allies. Reasons to watch this? You got the craziest son of a bitch of all time acting-wise in Gary Busey, playing Special Agent Peter Keyes, who later has a kid that's mentioned in The Predator. And you got Danny Glover as Lieutenant Mike Harrigan. And you can see in Harrigan, if you look into a character study, some signs of Roger Murtaugh from Lethal Weapon in there, but definitely a darker character, as well as the Xenomorph Queen's head on the Predator ship in the trophy area. Now, this film is much better than Shane Black's The Predator, but you have to watch this one before you watch The Predator. And for fans of this franchise, we will possibly be getting more R-rated content from the Predator franchise under the 20th Century Entertainment banner wing from Disney. So there you go. Coming in at number 74 is Hanging with the Homeboys, a 1991 art house film that had a short life in theaters, but caught on with indie audiences on home video. It's Friday night. It starts in the Bronx, goes into Manhattan, and the story revolves around four friends that have a guy's night out that goes sideways with disaster throughout the night and fractures the bonds and friendships that the friends had. Now, this film doesn't get a lot of credit because there are many, many more predominantly minority films that came out in the 90s that are more well-known, but this is a dramedy that just allows you to take in a strong lesson. And this film shows the growth of all four characters as well. You've got solid chemistry and a film that, honestly, if you haven't seen it, you should check it out at least once. Moving on to number 73, and it's the first hot button we're pushing here this week, Jackie Brown, Quentin Tarantino's third full-length feature directorial effort, which is based on the Leonard Elmore film book, Rum Punch. This is about a flight stewardess who's caught up in a web of deceit in a scheme where the friend is running guns from Mexico, and the web of deceit involves two people that work for the guy who's running the operation who want $500,000 for themselves. And on top of that, you've got a bail bondsman who's falling for the stewardess. It's a fun ride, and although I do object to Quentin Tarantino's use of the N-word, it is nowhere near as much being used in this film as it is in The Hateful Eight. And for those who complain that Tarantino is too violent in content, this is actually very tame in his least violent film. So consider that, you know. When you look at Kill Bill Volume 1, where, you know, the bride takes out the crazy 88s, this is definitely less violent. Coming at number 72 is Dead Presidents from 1995. This is the Hughes brothers' second film as directors. Lawrence Tate plays Anthony Curtis, who, after he graduates high school, signs up for the Vietnam War. When Anthony comes back home to the Bronx after the war, he ends up turning, unfortunately, to a life of crime to support his family. Now, Katara, you know well how I feel about our vets, right? I feel very strongly about them, as you well know, right?
Yes.
Yeah. You see, this is a very deep film to watch because when some vets return home from war, as Katara, myself, Nikia Miller, everybody here at the network could tell you, when vets return home from war, they are lost in the shuffle on how to make ends meet. You know, it's hard for them. Some of them find work. Some of them do end up with PTSD because of war and everything else. Now, I know some people are complaining that this film made the list, but honestly, it's a hard lesson to grasp for some. And yeah, we need to do more for our vets in current day and in the future as well as in the past. Solid film, and it's a must-see. My favorite genre's back, Guitar number 71. We're going into black comedy to die for, 1995. Okay, everyone knows I love black comedy, and this film fits into that category. Suzanne Stone, who's played by Nicole Kidman, wants to be a television newscaster and will stop at nothing to accomplish her goals. Okay, this one's one for the books. It's brutally honest, it's funny as hell, it's diabolical, and it's twisted. Yeah. Okay, it's politically incorrect and warped, absolutely. But back in the 90s, I know Katara and I heard of A Current Affair and Hard Copy. You know, the tabloid shows over sensational journalism. We still get that with Inside Edition from time to time. It also deals with sensationalism in media as well. And it's a good thing because this film works on all these ends. All in all, Gus Van Sant puts out another one in the win column film-wise. I will never forgive him for his remake of Psycho, but this was a good movie. Coming in at number 70, time to push a hot button here. Disclosure from 1994, based on the Michael Crichton novel, same name. Now, I'm going to get shit for this one, but the book was turned into a decent film. The book is better, per usual, but the movie's pretty decent, and it is a good watch. It's about sexual harassment in the workplace, but now the tables have turned, and it's a man being sexually harassed by his former lover, who happens to be his new boss as well. Now, people are going to scream that this film made the list well before the Me Too era, but the truth be told is that the film will make you think. It's a solid adaptation of it, and Demi Moore and Michael Douglas are in standout performances in this film, so that's why you should see it. Katara, you ready to stir the pot?
Sure, why not?
Time to get people triggered. Number 69 is Wes Craven's New Nightmare. Say, oh, Lord, for me. You know, I don't understand the hate this film gets from people who love Scream and say, well, this film sucked. Look, this film, along with Friday the 13th, Part 6, Jason Loves, along with especially Child's Play 2 and Child's Play 3 and Wes Craven's New Nightmare, they set the meta tone that Scream had. So it missed me with, oh, but Scream was an original thought, but the meta nature owes itself to several films beforehand. And this seventh installment of the Nightmare franchise, Freddy Krueger, is back. He's haunting the set of the new Nightmare film. They brought Freddy Krueger into reality in this one. The New Line rejected this idea back in 1986 in the development of Dream Warriors, so this was something new. Now, I know a lot of people are going to whine about this film because Freddy isn't funny in this one, but as you all know, Dream Master and Freddy vs. Jason aside, I can't with nonstop comedic Freddy. He's got to be scary, darkly funny, sparingly. Coming at number 68 is who's the main starting Dr. Dre and Ed Lover? Now, I know people are right now saying, wait, Sith, Dr. Dre the rapper? No. Talking about the Dr. Dre that was the host of Yo! MTV Raps, and also for years, along with Ed Lover, had a morning show on Hot 97 out of New York for years. In this one, Dr. Dre, Ed Lover, play two barbers who aren't good at it at all. So they decide to become police officers. Their duty sergeant, he's played by Dennis Leary, gets in the way, but puts someone in his army to eradicate all crime in 24 hours. It's a fun watch. You get the greatness of Dennis Leary combined with the fun and humor of Dr. Dre and Ed Lover together. And Dennis Leary will be mentioned in two films way deeper in the countdown. Coming at number 67 is Airheads from 1994, starring Brendan Fraser, C.B. Sheeny, and Adam Sandler. Think Bog Day Afternoon with comedic heavy metal, okay, with a twist. When a struggling band can't get a record deal, nobody signs them, they're stuck playing clubs, and the labels don't want to talk to them, they take a radio station hostage. Okay, this film is a crazy watch, but it has a lot of fun in it. You have the twist of the station changing formats from heavy metal, from hard rock, to easy listening. You've got the question of who wins in a wrestling match, Lemmy or God. The secretary and Pip have a fling, and the fracturing rebuilding of another relationship as well. All in all, it's a fun cult film, bombed in the theaters, but thanks to HBO and VHS, it really caught on. Coming in at number 66 is Beavis and Butthead Do America. Yeah, I'm going there. You have to take in mind, I'm 46 years old, and back in the day, I actually enjoyed watching Beavis and Butthead on MTV when they discussed music videos. You know, for people like me who like Mystery Science Theater 3000, think of it as Mystery Science Theater 3000 with two cartoon characters instead of robots. Instead of B-movies, they're cracking jokes on music videos. It's a simple plot. Their TV's been stolen, so Beavis and Butthead go on a road trip across America. I can't help it. This film's a guilty pleasure. This was just as these guys were in their heyday. Wasn't too hip to their millennium return, in case people are asking. All in all, it's a fun film, but you just have to endure the fact that these guys will live on forever thanks to this film and the early 90s. We're at number 65, and at number 65 is Alien 3, and now I've lost all street cred with 100% of the Wayne Yutani group on Facebook. Look, when I first saw this film opening weekend, I saw it on Saturday night, the night after it opened. I was extremely pissed off big time. However, in time, ask Katara. I've been able to get over the opening credits and the ending and see this film for what it is. Studio exec interference aside, it's a decent watch. You just have to measure your expectations because it's nowhere near as good as Alien or Aliens. That being said, Lieutenant Ripley ends up on Fury 161, which is a former penal colony that's now just a mining facility that's ran by the former inmates. That being said, she brings along an unwelcome visitor in more ways than one. Oh, and there are no weapons in this film on the planet. No guns. That was per request of Sigourney Weaver. She wanted to see an alien film without guns. If you can't overlook this film with its flaws, but yet you praise the prequel films, take a seat. The prequel films, along with Resurrection and this one, are all one and the same. They're not great films, but they're good films. They're very flawed films, but good. And guess what? The people that hated me for last few films, Katara, they're coming back for this one. Because number 64, Brian De Palma's Mission Impossible. You know where Edge from U2 did the theme? And you had Tom Cruise hanging from the wire to do the computer hacking? Yeah, really good stuff. Now, this film launched a film franchise that is still ongoing, and we'll be counting down that franchise next month along with a few others. In the first film, Ethan Hunt is on the track to prove his innocence after he's framed for the murder of most of his IMF team. This film honestly restarted the franchise, and honestly, as Katara could tell you, I enjoy all six films. In this one, though, it's not my favorite of the six. Is a good, steady, nice watch. It's got great pacing, great stunts, solid directing, writing, and acting. Katara, I'm a bit confused bringing you on for a second. Yes, I am confused whether I like Ghost Protocol more or Fallout, but let's be determined next month. I might have to watch Fallout again just to see if I like it a little bit more than this protocol. Just to give you a hint.
Okay, cool.
But guess what? We're about to lose the people that came back to our side again with Mission Impossible, because number 63 is Hellraiser Bloodline, and we just lost those people again. Okay, look, y'all, this is the final theatrical release for the Hellraiser franchise, whereas after this film, Dimension opted to go direct-to-video. Honestly, it probably should have gone direct-to-video a couple of years prior. In this installment, it's 2127, and Dr. Paul Merchant is isolated in a room aboard Space Station Minos that he designed. He has a plan, an endgame, if you will, to destroy the Lament configuration and finally closing the gateways between Hell and Earth for good. But then get into the prequel part. Know the backstory about the box, how it was created in that 1796 in France, and also how the Merchant Curse went through New York City in 1996. Now, if you ignore the gaping plot issues and the fact that the studio, again, interfered a lot, it's a decent film, but it's far from the best. But it's improvement slightly on Hell on Earth, and definitely better than the direct-to-video films. Hey, Katara, remember the Crypt Keeper?
I sure do.
Coming in at number 62 is Tales from the Crypt, Demon Knight. You see, Katara and I remember Tales from the Crypt. I love that show. I used to watch it weekly religiously. In this one, the Crypt Keeper gives us the story of Frank Breaker, who's carrying the last of seven keys, special containers that hold the blood of Christ and kept the universe from protection of evil. If the collector gets the last key, evil takes over the universe. This is a strange movie, and it was supposed to start up a trilogy, but after Bordello of Blood failed, and it was horrible, by the way, HBO abandoned the idea of a trilogy. It's a fun film for those of us who love the HBO series, or the film Creepshow, or the Shudder series Creepshow. Going back into the book department here at number 61, The Pelican Brief from 1993. Okay, get this. Like The Firm, it's not the best idea to an adaptation, but it's still a good film, and this is another Grisham novel, and it is a decent watch. When two Supreme Court justices are killed, Darby Shaw tries to solve the murder with a Washington Herald reporter, Gary Grantham. You also have the subplot of Darby finding out that her lover's death was linked to her finding out about the fate of the justices. The book is better, as most books are better than the films adapted, but the other side of the coin is you get Denzel Washington and Julia Roberts in a really good time thriller. I understand why they toned the book down for PG-13. I understand the reasoning, but I would have been better off with an R rating in this one, but it's still a good watch. Another adaptation, and somewhere Tom Clancy's cursing me out, because coming in at number 60 is Clear and Present Danger from 94. This was the third adaptation of Tom Clancy's work, and honestly, if you have Amazon Prime, they have a show there, Jack Ryan, which is really kick-ass. But up until that came out, this is as good as it gets for the Jack Ryan adaptations. I liked Shadow Recruit. I liked some of All Fears, but I digress. They weren't as good as the series on Prime, or this one, or Patriot Games, or Hunt for Red October. In this film, you get the war between Jack Ryan and a small group of people working with the president who are going rogue to win the drug war. And you get the subplot of the introduction of John Clark, who's one of my favorite characters in the Jack Ryan universe. Now, like with adaptations, this is toned down from the book. This is actually re-rated PG-13 on appeal. Oh, and Katara, good news for us. Guess who the new John Clark is? You're going to love this.
I don't know.
Michael B. Jordan is
playing.
Michael B. Jordan is John Clark.
John Clark. And okay, sorry, I was doing something.
He's the guy
in
the
what
CIA.
Movie?
They're going to be doing Without Remorse. It's due out on October 2nd. And Michael B. Jordan is John Clark. So, you know, my interest is I'm there. I'm there.
Cool.
Because, you know me, I think the world of Michael B. Jordan, I think he did a great job playing Apollo Creed's son, among other things. This is going to be like, we're at number 59, and oh boy, we're going to get some hate mail here. Halloween H2O from 98. Okay, this is where I don't have a problem with retcon, but to some it is. You had to retcon the excellent Halloween 3, which was an anthology story, but this also retcons the Jamie Lloyd trilogy, 4, 5, and Curse of Michael Myers. In this installment, which is supposed to be the final, which was at the time supposed to be the final film, Laurie Strode is presumed dead after a car accident via a file, but is actually missing. She's actually in California, teaching in a private boarding school, trying to rid herself of her past with Michael. Now, the reasons to watch this film, it bookends the franchise, and although it is somewhat like Scream, a lot like late 90s horror, it's the sequel, if you discount Season of the Witch, which is on par with the original. Okay, so they retconned the Jamie Lloyd trilogy. You needed to retcon Halloween 5. That was miserable to sit through. They should have left out Resurrection and allowed for a remake, but what's done is done. Coming in at number 58 is The Truman Show starring Jim Carrey. Now, with this film, this really is where Jim Carrey really started to take things off from what started with The Cable Guy, where you get rid of some of the slapstick from In Living Color and Ace Ventura and Dumb and Dumber, and it's set aside for darker overtones. When Truman Burbank realizes his whole life is a nonstop TV show for all to see and not his actual life, he tries to escape from it. Now, Jim Carrey barely gets credit for the darker films in his filmography, and instead people typecasted him as a silly insane role. It's like what he did with In Living Color, which was awesome. This film shows his genius, though, through and through, and definitely makes a list of films you need to see at least once. We're back to Michael Crichton file again at number 57, because at number 57 is Rising Sun from the summer of 93. A professional mistress is found dead in the offices of a Japanese corporation. The murder investigation turns into a deep investigation involving Detective Webb Smith and a former police captain, John Connor, who later find out that there's a darker web than things appear. This is a really good tongue suspense thriller that doesn't let you go. You've got solid chemistry between Sean Connery and Wesley Snipes in this one. And yeah, there was a conflict with Michael Crichton because of the casting of Wesley Snipes, because Webb Smith is Caucasian in the novel. However, it's controversial in other parts because of the portrayal of Japanese people. It's a better book to screen an adaptation than some of the other novels to screen in the decade. Definitely worth a watch if you like a suspense movie. And we're having a double shot of Sean Connery because at number 56 is The Rock. Yeah, from 96, the blockbuster that just grabs you. When a group of retcon Marines take over Alcatraz Island because families aren't reimbursed or given military funerals for deaths for clandestine missions, they end up with rockets with deadly gas that they will launch on San Francisco if payment isn't made in time, and it's up to an FBI chemist and an SAS captain to stop them. Hey, y'all, this is where Michael Bay was a decent director, you know, pre-Transformers. You know, the suspense and fun with this film can't be understated. And yeah, this does mark an end of an era because Don Simpson died during post-production, so Bruckheimer basically has been solo since, but still has an eye for producing hits, to say the least. All in all, it's a fun, right, knock 'em, sock 'em type film. And now we get into a little bit of sentimental here because coming in at number 55 is Back to the Future Part 3, the final story in the Back to the Future trilogy. After the ending of Part 2, Marty goes back in time to 1885, meets his ancestors, and tries to save Doc from getting killed by this Mad Dog Cannon. All right, now this is a good film as it bookends the trilogy and wraps up in a nice bow. But the issue again is that the nostalgia for the original is definitely missing here. However, there's good news for people like myself, and that is, despite the rumblings over the last 30 years, there will not be a sequel or reboot because Robert Zemeckis has the block, because he has the final rights to this series. So when they had the cartoon on CBS on Saturday mornings, that was with his approval, but he has shut down any idea at all because he's got final rights. So there you go. This ends the series. Coming in at number 54 is Hardware from 1990, which was mentioned in the top 100 films. You have two Before You Die countdown a few months back. So it lands here in the top 90s films, you have to see. Okay, in the 21st century, Earth has become a radioactive wasteland after a nuclear war. So when a head of a cyborg reactivates itself, it rebuilds them with deadly results. It's a tense sci-fi thriller. I love these films that get rated X originally for violence, because the film company didn't want the rating for the film to be linked to porn, so it was toned down for an R rating. I have a question for whoever owns the rights to this film. Could you get the original cut, take in all the deleted scenes you have on Blu-ray and DVD, splice those in properly, and give us the X-rated cut, and just release it unrated? That would be awesome. It's a solid film, and honestly, it's a cult film that's awesome. We're going into Shakespeare territory, folks, because coming in at number 53 is the 1990 version of Hamlet. I had to be specific here. Francis Zeffirelli directed this version. Kenneth Branagh did the 96 version. Now, this is the abridged version of Shakespeare's... Yeah, this is the abridged version about Prince Hamlet's plot to take of taking vengeance and try to take control of the kingdom from his uncle. Why is it abridged? Because the 96 version, although it's set in the 19th century, it's 4 hours long, does the full play. This film, though, is 2 hours and 14 minutes long, so it's edited by about, say, an hour and 46 minutes. Solid acting and directing here. And I saw this at the Westington Theater, which used to be at our house theater, which is closed. Man, the seats were uncomfortable there. But yeah, 1990s Hamlet, number 53. Coming in at number 52 is Havana from 1990. The film is very controversial because of the plot. Okay, why the controversy? That's what Qatar is wondering right now. Well, it's because it takes the night place, the night before the Cuban Revolution. It's the story of Jack Wheel, who is a World War II Navy vet, and he's a professional gambler who arrives in Cuba on the eve of the revolution, gets caught up in the middle of it, bummed at the box office, and Qatar, you ready for a factoid? You'll like this.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
You know how we have that law that U.S. dollars are not allowed in Cuba? Remember that law? So guess where the film was made?
In Cuba.
No, Dominican Republic.
Right?
Does it look just like Cuba?
Oh, okay.
So it makes sense. You know, you can't film in Cuba because the United States didn't want money going into Cuba. So, you know, go to the next closest thing, Dominican Republic. It's a nice drama film that, honestly, you should give it a second viewing if you've put it off. If you saw it the first time, or if you haven't seen it, you should give it a viewing. We wrap up the first part of the countdown at number 51, and it's American Pie. The Porky's for the Millennials, basically, from 98. It's the story of a group of high school seniors who make a pact to lose their virginity before graduation. When you look at the cast, about the only two people that are really broken out successfully, Sean William Scott and Natasha Lyonne. Natasha Lyonne was in Orange is the New Black on Netflix. Sean William Scott was in a couple of action films. He also had a cameo in Old School in 2003. Now, the downfall of this film is, of course, oversaturation of sequels and direct-to-video spinoffs. But this film still holds a bit of nostalgia with me. The jokes are sophomoric, yes. The pie scene is insane. And the writers did credit Bachelor Party in Porky's as inspirations. So if you love this film, haven't seen Bachelor Party in Porky's, watch those two. Oh, we're halfway through the countdown. Next week, 50 to 26. Then in 2 weeks, we're wrapping it up with the top 25. That's time to go into my inbox and break out some Q&A. If you want to find me on Twitter, it's at TrueSithDan74 on Twitter. So, Sith, we know you're an unabashed 80s guy, but honestly, what is your top five worst 80s films? This is a good one. Because as much as I love the decade of my youth, some films are straight up trash that belongs locked away and hidden from sight. So here goes my top five. And I'm going to do it in descending order. And number five, Tarzan the Ape Man. Look, if you want an 80s Tarzan film that's solid and a good watch, go watch Greystoke, The Legend of Tarzan, Lord of the Apes. Avoid this crappy movie because, honestly, it was horrible when I saw this when I was 16, and I still don't like it. And please, do not put this out on Blu-ray. Please don't do it. Number four, Leonard Part 6. Hey, Qatar, this would be really good punishment for kids today. Make them watch Leonard Part 6.
Okay.
No need for resting bitch face. No need for the paddle, for the belt. Leonard Part 6. You're watching Leonard Part 6. The kids would go nuts because it's so horrible. Okay? Bill Cosby, even before the film's release, disavowed the film. Okay? Trust me, this film's torture enough on the mind and soul. Number three, Mac and Me. Essentially, it's an E.T. ripoff, and honestly, it should have stayed far away from the theaters. It never should have even seen the light of day on video either. I don't think the filmmakers cared about the monstrosity they released on humankind with this one. Just horrible. And the product placement, I'm out of here. No, not good. Number two, this was a toss-up for my top two here, but I'm going with Star Trek V for number two. Because the only time I watch it is I'm doing a marathon of all the Star Trek films. I hated this movie so much that if not for the fact I got to see it for free opening night because we were doing publicity at the movie theater, it's now closed. My mom and my sister were holding me back from walking out. I probably would have walked out and snuck into a screening of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. And number one, A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, Dream Child. Far from an improvement from Dream Master. Film flat out sucks. Now, like Halloween 5, I won't skip over it in a marathon. But if Qatar says, Dream Child's on, I'm going to groan. Because it's so hard to sit through the biker kill aside. So there you go, the five worst films of the 80s. Sith, name a musician that is beloved that you find to be overrated. All right, look. I know he's beloved, but honestly, with the exception of Baby, I Love Your Way, and Do You Feel Like We Do? Peter Frampton. Frampton is overrated. Okay, I get that people like him. I get the nostalgia, but I would want to run away from Frampton as much as possible. Why? Involvement in a film that's discussed in the next question, that ruined all credibility for me. Sith, name a film that you think never should have been screened to anyone at all. That's easy. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Now, one thing about the 70s is that you had a lot of cocaine and a lot of drugs around, and in some films, as well as music productions, you had those things put into the budget. That being said, This is a completely fucked up, horrendous film that's fueled by a bunch of 70s musicians strung out on hard drugs and taking one of the greatest albums of all time and destroying it. It's just sad. It makes Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park look like Godfather in comparison. That film sucked just as bad. Question 4. Seth, do you have any hopes of the Wizards coming into the playoffs when they restart the NBA season? Do you think it's the end of the line? Sadly, John Wall's not 100%. I just don't see it happening. I've been a Wizards fan my entire life, back when they were the Bullets, but I just don't see it happening. I can wish and hope, but it won't get far, I fear. If they somehow get in as the 8th seed, this ain't going to be pretty. So I'm kind of hoping in a way that we kind of miss out on the top 8 seeds and just kind of heal up, get ready for next season. Question 5. Seth, how do you feel about the NHL playoff alignment idea when they get back to starting to finish the season? What is this, amateur hour, Gary Bettman? I mean, really, I get that the NHL is trying to make it fair for some of the teams that would have been left out of the postseason, and that the regular season didn't end, nor did the NBA season. But damn, who the hell is going to watch the Florida Panthers? They hardly get people into the arena beyond opening week. Same with the Phoenix Coyotes. Now, look, I get the gesture of trying to generate revenue and trying to get the players back on the ice, etc. But Bettman has no issues with locking out players because of waiver disputes, so I'm amazed he's on board with us. Question 6. Who are the biggest threats to NHL fans? Go ahead, get your shit off if you can. Well, damn. There are 5 people on this list, and I'm going to do it in order from 5 to 1. You've got Pierre McGuire, Gary Bettman, Jim Rutherford, Mike Milbury, Mark Madden. So, least offensive to worst, here you go. At number 5, Jim Rutherford. The Pens GM is a threat to all hockey fans. His trades, except to acquire Phil Kessel, who he traded to Arizona after back-to-back cups, are complete trash for the most part, and people in Carolina sure don't miss him either. Okay, he single-handedly completely destroyed and demolished things in Raleigh with the Carolina Hurricanes after they won the Stanley Cup in the 2006 campaign. And if not for the fact that Mike Sullivan is a good coach, he probably would have gotten away with it again in Pittsburgh. If not for the fact that in 2015, everyone was avoiding the Pens GM job because they didn't want to deal with the drama of firing Dan Bylsma when the Pens kicked the can to the next GM. Instead of a package firing, people might have taken the job before JR took it. Number 4, Mike Milbury. Why in the world is the Shoe Tosser still employed by NBC Sports? You know, a lot of his takes on hockey and studio are laughable at best. And please take in mind, his moves while being the GM of the Islanders have people from Long Island to Brooklyn reeling at the sight of him when he shows up. Now, I know that in studio, he's surrounded by Liam McHugh, who's a dunce when it comes to hockey, and Keith Jones, who's bitter because he was never part of a cup-winning team, yet he thinks he can pick out teams that are worthy of winning cups. But Mike is the worst hands out of 3. Oh, and his commentary? Get the fuck out of here. It's horrible. Number 3, Mark Madden. Holy hell, this guy's a threat to all hockey fans. We've talked about him before here. His toxicity on the air is bad enough, but his pure ignorance and reliance on anonymous sources to get scooped on the Pensacola's narrative is putrid at best. Boy, this cat as much as possible. I ran it on him big time, and honestly, I don't know what's worse. His lack of hockey knowledge 101, his lack of reliable anonymous sources, his trolling of people who don't agree with him, or his failed attempt to be a sports version of Howard Stern. Ugh, just toxic, dude, toxic. Coming in at number 2, and you got to bear in mind, Number two and number one are interchangeable, but number two is Pierre McGuire. Is it just me, or when he's inside the glass, players are going like, dude, it's an interview, not a meetup for drinks later on. But here's the biggest problem I have with Pierre. He demanded that one of the best fans of the NHL, Cy Clark, be removed from a hockey game because he had to sign with his real first name, Regis. Not to mention, Cy Clark was dying of cancer, and this was the last game he attended before he died. Guy's just a total dick. Period. You know, he's a dick, he's a train wreck, and thankfully he's off the A-team for NBC and replaced with Brian Boucher. Brian Boucher, definitely a better interviewer than Pierre McGuire. Pierre Regis, whatever you want to call him, is not someone who's on the level, and honestly, he's a threat to the fans. And top of the line, worst, is Gary Bettman. This man is responsible for three lockouts. He's an enemy to the game. He finds a way to hurt the fans, even though he's saying, oh, it's for the public interest. Also, he thought it was wise for South Florida and Arizona to have NHL franchises. What the hell, dude? After opening week, their attendance drops quick. He's just a useless, ignorant piece of shit who honestly is also responsible for not having the Winter Classic games on New Year's Day in Canada because he wanted to separate Canada to host the Heritage Classic. Nice try, asshole. You should have seen if the Winter Classic could be held in Canada as well as a way to remember the history of the game. Not separate the two ideas. Just a complete scumbag. Now, bear something in mind, folks. You take these five people in any order. Besides, if you don't agree with me on the order, you can pick them in any order. You get the top threats of all NHL fans. Not a single person on this list has any redeeming value whatsoever. Period. Final question, and this is going to pique Qatar's interest because Qatar knows I'm a big Genesis fan. Qatar, people wanted to know if I liked Peter Gabriel or Phil Collins better as a solo artist outside of Genesis. Do you know how tough this is?
Tell us how tough it is.
This is very tough. You should know this. This is very tough on me. Okay? Let me preface this. Peter and Phil both put their stamp on Genesis. With Peter, it was the theatrical art rock style of performing. And with Phil, it was when they moved towards the mainstream vibe of what Genesis became in like the late 70s through the 90s. Really tough. Love both of them as solo artists. They both have works that resonate with me by Peter Gabriel. All right. The video for Sledgehammer, and then when I was getting it fresh out of high school, the video for Steam, that elevates it just a slight bit higher. It's so close. That's how crazy this is. It is so close. Okay. Time for my rant. And again, this is not for kids, but you're going to end up regretting this probably if you let your kids listen, but that's all fine and good, but it's time to listen up. Good evening, planet Earth. What the fuck are we offended by now? Are you offended because someone was wearing a Black Lives Matter shirt, hat, or has a saying on a social media profile? Are you offended because it's woke not to openly support police and someone has a blue badge on their social media profile? Are you offended because someone decided to come out of the closet? Are you offended because a neighbor you thought was on your level politically came out as a member of your political opposition? Are you offended because there's a TV show, a movie, a radio station, a book that triggers you? Are you offended because I rank a movie or song lower or dare have it on a countdown to begin with? Are you triggered because I'm a libertarian and I refuse to buy into Trump or Biden? Are you offended because I'm triggering everyone that I can with this rant? Guess what? Nobody fucking cares about you being offended. Nobody does. Okay? I don't understand how in the last 30 years we've gone from being able to speak on anything candidly and instead have gone into a slippery slope where if you even bother to disagree on anything civilly, somebody gets offended. Someone gets triggered. This all started in the early 90s where there was this idea that we need to be politically correct. Because you know, it's rather funny. The people calling for us to be more politically correct, past and present, have racial issues within their skeletons in their closet as well. But you're supposed to turn a blind eye to that and obey and consent as to what they are saying. Gone are the days where you can be candid about things and you had to become more, you know, sensitive and caring towards others. Now, don't get me wrong. There's some things that you need to be sensitive about. People with disabilities, people with health issues, etc. But there's certain things that people totally overblow, and we're going to get to that in a minute. But spoiler alert, I've been offending people here on the right and the left in this network for 5 fucking years now. And now, as my dead relatives and God as witnesses, I will continue to do that every single chance I see to do so. Here we go, Pop. Here we go. We live in a world where the phrase, I'm offended, is somehow something that we should be mindful about things. We're told that we need to use cancel culture to get rid of movies, statues, street names, building names, TV shows, books, music, etc. because of things that took place in a different time period. Yes, instead of using them as teaching lessons, we're told, no, you have to remove them because it's offensive. Yes, you have the right to be offended, but here's something you aren't supposed to know. The people that are mainly in charge of gaslighting you to try to cancel everything have a ton of guilt on their consciences. If they've been trying to deflect blame as elected officials mostly, that they're not doing their jobs, so they're pointing at Columbus, Confederates, their founding fathers, they're pointing at movies and books. I mean, they're pointing at books like A Clockwork Orange, they're, you know, et cetera, and music, and telling you to cancel all of pop culture and history. This is the problem. Not with us not doing our jobs that you put us in office for. So I have an idea. Why don't we cancel everything revolving every political, military, religious, monarch, etc., when the pilgrims settling in Massachusetts, as well as all over the colonies, and later slaughtering Native Americans, all the way up and including Abraham Lincoln, who said that he would keep slavery intact if it could keep the Union together. And he also said that, well, he could, if he could abolish slavery and keep the Union intact, he would do that as well. Why don't we cancel Nixon for his Southern strategy as well as his annihilation and destruction of the Black Panthers? LBJ for his racist ideas, including his real feelings towards the Civil Rights Act. Bill Clinton, a shitload of other politicians for the 1994 crime bill. Why don't we disown Rudy Giuliani and everyone who supported Stop and Frisk? Why don't we get rid of JFK and his brothers for working with Southern governors and the feds to get Martin Luther King Jr. in prison for suspicions of being a communist? Yeah, and what happened was they got him out of prison after people were so outraged because there was no way he could be a communist that they had to save face and get him released. Cancel both Trump and Biden. Both have made racially charged statements in the past as well. But this goes on with these people, and not to mention fucking Hollywood and their nonstop bullshit where it comes to their lies about race and unity, as people in Hollywood are just as racist. You see, people are just focused on Columbus, Confederates, and Trump. They don't want to take it all the way. I support Kaepernick's right to protest, as well as all NFL players. They have that right. But my attitude of you're going to boycott the NFL because you don't like the protests, the stop watching NFL Network, stop patronizing the sponsors of the NFL, get out of all NFL Facebook groups, get off all their social media, etc. But y'all ain't going to do that, so just have a seat. Quit being offended. See, get this. I can't stand the movie Gone with the Wind. It's a film that, honestly, I've never cared for. And honestly, I could go without seeing it for the rest of my life. Qatar, have you seen Gone with the Wind? And if so, did you like it, yes or no?
I have no interest in seeing Gone with Wind, but let's be clear. HBO does that to movies all the time.
They do.
They just quiet about it. So it's like,
yep,
who
exactly.
cares? And plus, I think they changed their mind anyway. So it doesn't matter.
They may have. I have to double check that. But anyway. But you see, do I support them at the initial polling? No, because here's why. I'm sick of people getting their way when they get fucking offended. Fuck me. As Qatar, I get offended by a lot of shit. I'd be a multimillionaire if I whined about it also. You know, I'd be a multimillionaire. All kidding aside, I was raised better than to whine and fuss over being offended over every little thing. It goes like this. You don't like a movie? Don't watch it. Don't like guns? Don't own one. Don't like abortion? Don't get one. Don't like Kanye because he supports Trump? Don't listen to him anymore. Don't support same-sex marriage? Don't tell people who are same-sex not to get married. Don't like your kids watching Paw Patrol? Tell them they can't watch it. But stop with this idea that because you're offended, everyone should pay a price. Okay? That's the problem with cancel culture. Right there. Is that...
HBO is different, though. HBO does this.
HBO is different.
Are a cable company. Right.
I would love HBO to actually put Roots on.
Right.
Guess
but
what?
They pull things like... Yeah, but they don't. They won't. That's the thing. They pull
they
movies
won't.
All the time.
That
so
would
it's
be great.
It's not really neat. Right, but it's not really a
yeah.
big deal for. I don't see the issue because they do it all the time, and no one says anything else because they have the right
they
to
do
that. And it's not really cancel culture when they do it. They just do it like all cable companies do.
Yeah,
but that's my thing with that.
Yeah, I would love for them to show Roots on HBO Go. I mean, on HBO Plus. I mean HBO Max. And watch the same people that are whining about Gone with the Wind. Oh, God, you can't get off. Imagine what happens if Roots shows up. Ugh. The calls for the crying would be around the corner, and you know it. Because it's very deep, it's heartbreaking, and it's realistic as shit to this very day. And I leave you all with a quote here from Stephen Fry. He's a British actor. And I've posted this before. It's now very common to hear people say, I'm offended by that, as if it gives them certain rights. It's nothing more than a whine. It has no meaning. It has no purpose. It has no reason to be respected as a phrase. I'm offended by that. Well, so fucking what? Okay, folks, that's it for this week's installment of Sith Basement. Already working on next week's script, which is more Q&A, another rant possible. Numbers 50 to 26 in the 90s films. Katara, got a question for you before we get out of here.
Sure.
You're going to like this. So I'm going to end on a funny note. You know in my pro wrestling picks I've been below 500? Guess what? I'm already starting down that edge on that slope again, because during the pre-show I went 0-1 in my picks for tonight.
Oh, okay.
I just thought I'd end the show on a fun, humorous note because I was so controversial. So that way people can think of me so much of being an asshole. Anyway, we thank you all for listening tonight. Next week, Friday night, no spots, 10 p.m., we're going to break down Backlash, where I'm already 0-1, and we're also going to do the week in wrestling as well. Not sure what we're doing yet on True Talk this week yet or not, and stay tuned for so much more. Sports on the Hill podcast season 5 starts soon as well. Katara, do you have anything lined up at all that we need
nope.
to be made aware of this evening? Nope.
Not as of yet.
Okay, well, that's a wrap for us tonight here in the basement. For my producer, Katara, for everyone here at True Radio Network, we love you. We bid you a good night. A very happy tomorrow to you. We love you from the RVA, and we will see you next week, same time, same bat channel.